And last time we started talking about the nuclear triad, the notion of having three different ways to deliver weapons of mass destruction. And people think of this as a post-World War II Cold War concept developed by the Soviet Union and the US. But there's a lot of evidence we're discussing that this was actually developed during World War II by Germany. So last time we mostly talked about land-launched intercontinental ballistic missiles that were under development in Germany during the war. We'll finish that discussion this time and then get into sub-launched missiles and intercontinental jet bombers. Last time we talked about liquid propellant rockets that Germany was developing, and let's briefly mention the solid propellant rockets as well. Now, there had been solid propellants around since ancient China, but those solid propellants had their limitations. And by about 1943, German engineers had pushed those solid propellants to their limits, building rockets like the Rheintochter and the larger Rheinbote. The Rheinbote at the lower right here had approximately the same range as a V2, but it was a much smaller rocket with a much smaller payload. And Germany really wasn't able to push that particular old solid propellant rocket method much further than this. So there were several different German and Austrian engineers and chemists who developed improved solid propellant rockets. And this was called ammonium perchlorate composite propellant, and we still use these nowadays. Most large solid propellant rockets used for ICBMs and sub-launch missiles, and used for launching satellites into space and boosters. These still use this propellant that was developed by these and other German and Austrian scientists. And after the war, these folks were interrogated by the United States and by other countries. And actually, most of the key people here went to work for France after the war, developing French post-war missiles. During the war, they were not only developing the propellant, they were developing up to very large-sized rockets to use it. Here is one described in post-war Allied reports. During the war, they were developing something called the V-101, described as a solid propellant rocket that was 30 meters tall, so about 100 feet tall, basically like a wartime version of a Minuteman ICBM or something. It's unclear just how far they got. Unfortunately, most of the reports on this are still classified and unavailable. As I mentioned, these folks were interrogated after the war. Many of them went to France, but before they did, they were interrogated by Americans, among others. And in particular, Fritz Zwicky was Swiss. He was a German-speaking scientist himself, but he was working for the Americans during the war. And he interrogated many of these people at the end of the war, and then brought their solid propellant rocket technology back to the United States to Aerojet, a company for which he was consulting, and to the U.S. War Department. So here's evidence of transfer of these technologies. Here's additional evidence of transfer of these technologies. Donald Putt was a colonel, later a general in the U.S. Army Air Forces, and he was one of the folks in charge of rounding up German-speaking scientists and bringing them back to the United States as part of Paperclip. And so he wrote this memo discussing some of the German rocket scientists he'd rounded up and said they were available to help the US and that, based on the scientists, based on all the documentation he'd found, they were far ahead of the United States in their solid propellant rockets. Here is another example. This is Karl Klauger. After the war, he was brought to the United States and proceeded to invent all kinds of important things used for sub-launch missiles and solid propellant missiles. So it appears that these German solid propellant rocket technologies were incorporated after the war into the first large U.S. solid propellant rockets, like the U.S. Navy's Polaris, the Army's Pershing, and the Air Force's Minuteman missiles. Now let's move on and talk about submarine launch missiles, which may or may not be solid propellant. And let's start with cruise missiles. One of the world's first cruise missiles was the German V-1, and this was first successfully flown in 1942. And then they built thousands of these during the war. And it was launched on a rail like this. Now, the V-1 itself is fairly well known. What is less well known are the modifications of the V-1 that were also developed during the war. And so here's a post-war Allied report on some of these modifications. They developed V-1s that could be piloted, so not just sent on automatic control, but with a pilot, possibly a suicide pilot, to deliver it to its target. There were versions of the V-1 that were launched not on a rail from the ground, but rather launched from under the wing of a large aircraft. So an aircraft could carry one or potentially several of these near a target and then launch them at the target. And there were even versions this report describes that were designed to be launched from submarines. Here is more information. This is from a highly placed German involved in these programs named Edmund Zorg. He was interrogated by the British after the war by Edmund Tilly, one of the very top German-speaking British interrogators. And so this is from the British National Archives. And Zorg described development during the war of an improved manned V-1 specifically to deliver an atomic bomb to its target. Here is further information on the interrogations of Zorg. He gave quite a bit of information about this nuclear-armed V-1. And then independently, we have this document on the right. Hans Kammler was a general in the SS, and by the end of the war, he controlled virtually all these secret weapons. And one of his final public orders, before he vanished into US custody, was ordering immediately blow up the V-1s near Berlin. Now, there were thousands of these V-1s all over German-controlled Europe. They weren't anything special, but these were very, very special V-1s, and he wanted them destroyed before Soviet forces entered Berlin. So they may well have been modified to carry nuclear payloads or other weapons of mass destruction. As I mentioned, these things could be launched from submarines. And so here is a report, and this is from 1944 to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States. Discussing German submarines that have been modified to launch V-1s from the deck, and these submarines could surface off the U.S. East Coast and target U.S. cities. Now, this is just a sketch, but this is a sketch by the Allies based on surveillance photos they'd taken. So, as of September 1944, the Allies had actual photographs of German submarines that have been modified to carry V-1s. Moreover, here is a bunch of evidence, many different communications from people, everyone from Dwight Eisenhower to Herbert Hoover, from late 1944 into early 1945, discussing very real German plans to send V-1s capable of launching, to send submarines capable of launching V-1s, perhaps nuclear armed, and to launch them at New York and other major US cities. It's unclear exactly why these plans didn't come to fruition, whether it was due to Allied bombing of German targets, or whether they tried and failed, or sabotage, or what was going on. Then, after the war, the US, after a couple of years, proudly displayed its brand new, all US developed technology. Which was a cruise missile capable of being launched from US submarines. And it just happens to look exactly like a carbon copy of a German wartime V-1. This is called the Loon in the US, and just happens to be launched from a US submarine, exactly like the wartime plans. But it was a very proud all-American invention as of 1947. There were other proud all-American inventions. They continued to develop cruise missiles, improving the technology up to the cruise missiles we have today. But if you peer under the rug, you find that all the dust bunnies under the rug all speak German. So here are lots of German and Austrian scientists and engineers working hard in the US to develop these cruise missiles. Let's move on to sub-launch ballistic missiles, not cruise missiles. And here were launches as early as 1942 of rockets from a submarine that was underwater. So this almost looks like the modern launch of a Polaris or Trident missile or something, but this was a smaller missile launched from a submarine underwater in 1942. This was done in collaboration with engineers from Peenemünde, the rocket base. And once they had demonstrated this with small rockets, they started doing it with larger and larger rockets. There was enough Allied surveillance and bombing on the Baltic coast that they switched over to Austria, a large lake in the middle of nowhere in Austria. And they were building larger and larger sub-launch missiles and testing, demonstrating them in Austria. Then the ultimate would be if you could deliver a sub-launched V2 or A4 rocket, a very large rocket with a fairly large payload. Now that type of rocket is too large to fit into any of the wartime submarines that they had. So they developed a solution. A German submarine would tow a submarine trailer. This trailer would initially be horizontal, be towed across the Atlantic, and the trailer would contain one of these V2 or A4 rockets. And then once they got off the coast of their target, they would flood one end of this trailer. That end would sink. Now the rocket would be upright. They'd open the doors and launch it. If you read the history books, officially this was purely a paper design, never got anywhere, never seriously contemplated. But here is documentation from one of the modern German U-boat museums saying that, oh yeah, during the war in 1944, they actually built these things and they were successfully doing trials to see how well a submarine could tow these things. So it was actually built. Here is additional evidence. This is from the French, who were also investigating German technologies after the war. So a French investigator after the war wrote about some of his discoveries, what the Germans had been doing during the war, including a submarine capable of launching V2s. It was actually built, and that the Germans planned to use that to get off the coast and to bomb American cities, including Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Charleston, that they planned to do this with atomic bombs. These amphibious V2s would carry atomic bombs. They planned to do this in conjunction with launching rockets from Europe at the United States. And according to this French investigator, Germany would have done this beginning in June 1945 if the war had not ended just when it did. There were other submarine technologies that were developed in Germany that were very critical. And prior to World War II, even in the early part of World War II, submarines had to be powered almost constantly by a diesel engine, which of course needed air, which meant they really couldn't submerge too far for too long. But that changed with the development of the so-called Type 21 U-boat. This U-boat was kind of like a giant Tesla. It had a huge number of batteries in the bottom of it, and so it could turn its diesel engine off after having charged these batteries, and then cruise around for quite a while underwater on battery power. Several of these Type 21s were captured by different nations at the end of the war and became the basis for a lot of post-war submarines in other countries. Another feature was that if your submarine is going to go cruising around underwater most of the time at fairly high speeds, then it needs to have a rounded front. Previously, submarines had a front, kind of like the front of a ship, because submarines had spent a lot of time on the surface, just like a normal ship. But for submarines going mainly underwater, mainly at high speeds, they needed a more rounded front. And there were several German prototype submarines that had this rounded front during the war. And this rounded front was incorporated into post-war submarines in the US and other countries. Excuse me. Then sonar, of course, you need sonar for submarines. And we think of this as a wartime World War II invention, possibly allied. No, here are some of the very first patents on sonar. This is from Germans and patented in 1912, so even before World War I. And then over the next several decades, sonar was developed, perfected by several different German companies, and was quite sophisticated in World War II. And these technologies, a lot of them were taken in by the Allies after the war. Not only sonar, but anti-sonar, the ability to dampen or diminish sonar returns from your vessel. This was a special coating that had been developed by German engineers and chemists. So special rubberized coating that was actually put on at least one large submarine and greatly reduced the sonar cross-section. Then, on top of the submarines, the ability to launch missiles directly from submarines. This was also transferred to the United States and other countries and fully utilized after the war. Here is the Polaris, the first major sub-launched missile in the United States after the war. And here is one of the proud inventors, Willy Fiedler. Doesn't sound very American. Here are all of his patents. I've already mentioned Karl Klauger, who was up to his ears in all this post-war development in the United States. And again, pick up the rug, and all of the dust bunnies speak German. Oodles and oodles of German and Austrian scientists and engineers involved in all aspects of these programs, contrary to what you read in the official history books. Same thing was true in the Soviet Union. After the war, the Soviets wanted to develop sub-launch missiles, and rather than starting from scratch, they simply used German technologies. So here is the first post-war Soviet sub-launch missile. It just happens to be a carbon copy of a wartime German missile that was kind of a smaller scale V-2 type rocket called Wasserfall. And it just happens to be launched from a Soviet sub that was actually a carbon copy of the wartime German Type 21 U-boat we already saw. There were other relevant technologies as well. You'd like to be able to communicate with your submarine missile fleet, wherever it is, even submerged, even on the far side of the planet. And sonar signals only travel so far. Radio signals really don't penetrate water terribly well, but extremely long wavelength radio signals will. So during the war, Germany built huge transmitters. This was one that covered many square miles, and it was called Goliath, and it transmitted on extremely low radio frequencies, though it passed through the earth and passed through water. And so they could communicate with their U-boats wherever they were. Then after the war, these technologies were taken to the US and to the Soviet Union. Here is a comparable US facility, Clam Lake, built in Wisconsin 40 years after the German version. Now let's talk about intercontinental jet bombers, the third part of the nuclear triad. And there are a number of well-known aircraft that were built in Germany, mass-produced in Germany during the war, that would have been capable of carrying the German nuclear weapons we talked about last time. And from all the archival documentation, there appear to have been at least three major types of German nuclear weapons, a small one that weighed about 300 kilograms, and there were many aircraft that could carry that. A medium one that weighed about 2 tons. There were aircraft that could carry that. And under development, almost ready by the end of the war, was a full-fledged German H-bomb that weighed 6 tons and would have had a megaton yield. So for all these cases, there are known German aircraft that could have carried these bombs. Most of them had a range, on the order of 1,000 kilometers or so. So these were not going to get to the United States in return, but they could certainly deliver these bombs to the UK or to Soviet targets. And then there were a couple with the range to just barely reach the US. But there were more advanced bombers under development. Here is evidence that there was more advanced stuff under development. This is a photo from the US National Archives, and it shows in 1948 a wartime German bomb that was found by Allied investigators and delivered to the United States for further study after the war. This bomb was designed to be airdropped, and this bomb weighed 16 tons. Now, you don't go building 16-ton bombs to be airdropped unless you have or are building aircraft capable of carrying 16-ton bombs. So exactly what aircraft did they have capable of carrying this thing? Here is a small example of an aircraft, a prototype aircraft. This is a flying wing. This was famously developed by the Horton brothers, and kind of a prototype stealth fighter, if you will. So we know that these small versions were built, but there's evidence that larger versions may have been built as well. After the war, some German engineers were talking to the Allied investigators. The Germans were unemployed. They were desperate for work, and they were trying to get work. So the Germans told the Allied investigators that for, simply paying them room and board, the Germans were prepared to very rapidly go to work building for the United States an aircraft with a 14,000-kilometer round-trip range and six jet engines and a flying wing, which they drew here. And if you squint and look at this diagram very closely, I think you can see Captain America hanging on right here. But anyway, if these German engineers were prepared to immediately start building this for the US after the war, it raises the question of exactly what they were doing during the war and exactly what they built during the war. Here is further evidence. This is a cable from Allen Dulles, sort of one of the resident spooks in Europe during the war. And he reports that Germany has developed, as of 1943, 1944, Germany has developed long-range bombers capable of reaching distant targets, delivering weapons of mass destruction, and that these long-range bombers were closely associated with an area south of Hamburg called Lüneburger Heide. This appears to have been one of the major German nuclear development sites. Here is another document. This is from a prisoner of war who was captured and reported that he had actually seen prototype aircraft developed and demonstrated during the war. Other reports after the war, Allied investigators in different parts of formerly German-controlled Europe found, prototype bombers here, prototype bombers there. These were different locations in Europe. These were different designs for bombers. So there were parallel programs developing these intercontinental bombers, and they reached the prototype or possibly even mass production phase. One of the most dramatic examples is from Norway. Norway was controlled by Germany throughout most of the war. And during the war, the Germans built extremely large airfields around Oslo, mysteriously large airfields. This was observed by Allied intelligence. And then at the end of the war, according to these reports, in the Washington Post and Stars and Stripes, other sources, at the end of the war, Allied investigators found 40 bombers on these airfields, in Norway. These were 40 large bombers, capable of reaching the United States. They were a brand new design from Heinkel, something unlike the previous designs, and designed to carry weapons of mass destruction. And they were, quote, held in readiness for missions to New York, and then captured at the end of the war. here's additional evidence for those airfields and those bombers. This is a prisoner of war who was captured and interrogated by the Allies. And the Allies tried everything they could to poke holes in his story. They never could. His story was that during the war, he had received a special training supervise bombs of chemical weapons. And then once he'd been trained, he was sent back to Norway and put in charge of overseeing stockpiles of these chemical bombs at Norway on the airfields. And the specific chemical weapon he describes sounds like a chlorine trifluoride. And it is an extremely nasty chemical weapon. It will basically dissolve almost anything, basically eat almost anything. So human flesh, clothing, metal, almost anything. And according to him, the Germans had mass-produced this weapon, stockpiled bombs of this, and these bombs were at the airfields in Norway, all ready to attack Allied targets. Now, those large bombers in Norway were said to be 40 bombers of a special new type built by the Heinkel Aircraft Company. Here is Ernst Heinkel, who ran the company, and here was his lead aircraft designer, Siegfried Günther. Here are some of Günther's designs showing these giant flying wing bombers. Now, officially, these were just purely paper designs, never built. But if you read the information from Heinkel after the war, if you read other documentation, it sounds as if perhaps some of these were built during the war, all the way up to, quote, a 60-ton flying wing bomber with a range of 28,000 kilometers, so easily able to reach the United States and return. And after the war, these German engineers were interrogated by Allied investigators. And then once Allied investigators had learned everything they could from them, then they didn't hire these Germans. They just kind of left them to rot. I think most of them ended up going to the Soviet Union. Now, to get a bomber across the Atlantic and ideally return, you need a fairly good aircraft engine for that, something fairly fuel efficient. And most of the engines up to that point in time had been old-fashioned piston propellers. Those would not have a terribly long range. You can calculate the range for these things just from simple equations using the relative lift of the aircraft, the drag of the aircraft, and the mass ratio of the aircraft, how much of the initial aircraft weight is propellant versus how much is aircraft hardware and people. So a piston propeller using about 40% of its initial load as fuel, it's fairly good, probably the best you can achieve, would have a maximum range of a little over 6,000 kilometers. So maybe it could reach across the Atlantic. It certainly couldn't return. The first jet engines at that time were called turbojets, and they had just slightly longer range, still not enough to go to the U.S. and return. What you really want is a turbofan or a turboprop engine. Of course, we use turbofans on most passenger aircraft nowadays, and that is much more fuel efficient and would have a range up to 15,000 kilometers, easily able to cross the Atlantic and return. And a turboprop is still used on a number of commercial aircraft, and that would have a roughly comparable range, about 18,000 kilometers or so. So if we could find those 40 prototype bombers in Norway, we may well find the first 80 production line turbofan or turboprop engines. And we actually know where those engines may have come from. This was Carl Leist. During the war, he was developing and building and testing turbofan engines. So by 1943, he had demonstrated the world's first known turbofan engine. But this was 1943, 2 years before the end of the war, plenty of time to get these things into mass production. That was turbofans. Here are turboprops. And Ferdinand Bronder and several other people were developing and building turboprop engines during the war. This is the Junkers Jumo version of this, this Junkers turboprop engine. Then after the war, these Junkers turboprop engines were used by the Soviet Union as the engines on their famous Tupolev 95 or Bear bombers. In fact, these are still in service. So these Russian bombers are flying 80 years later with these German-derived turboprop engines. Then there were many, many sources that reported after the war, very knowledgeable sources that reported that if the war continued, even just another month or two, that Germany would have brought a lot of these weapons of mass destruction and these delivery methods into action and used them against Allied cities. So this is from a high-ranking U.S. official based on these reports. If the war continued, the Germans would have smashed New York City with improved rockets, and they would have reached Washington, D.C. with jet-propelled intercontinental bombers. So he gave this testimony to the U.S. Congress. Likewise, the Convair Aircraft Company wrote after the war, based on their investigations on the ground in Germany, that Germans were prepared to launch rockets and, quote, destroy New York City and other American cities within a matter of months, and that they had also completed jet-propelled heavy bombers to drop bombs on Allied targets. This is from General George Marshall, reporting that German technological advances, such as the development of atomic explosives, made it imperative that we attack and end the war when we did, and that by the end of the war, Allied cities, U.S. cities, had come within range of German technologies to deliver these weapons. More reports. This is from Werner Vector, a fairly highly placed German official. He was captured by the Soviets and interrogated by the Soviet NKVD, the KGB, after the war. And he described both long-range rockets capable of carrying atomic bombs and long-range bombers capable of carrying atomic bombs. He says that all this was built, and this would have been used again just within a matter of months if the war had continued. Then, on top of those wartime technologies, a lot of this was developed and transferred after the war. And that included advanced radar technologies. We think, if you read the history books, we think of radar as being a wartime World War II British invention. Here is the first known radar system developed, invented by a German in 1903. So well before World War I, let alone World War II. And then a series of Germans who improved the radar systems here. Gave them higher powers, longer range, along with anti-radar technologies, the ability to reduce radar cross-section. So there were several different German scientists and engineers, and Austrian scientists and engineers, who were developing radar-absorbing coatings. These were actually installed on some submarines to prevent the submarines from being detected by radar. They're developing these coatings for aircraft as well. So these technologies were transferred to the United States after the war and became the basis for later stealth aircraft programs. There were so many different examples of German scientists and German technologies that were transferred. Here's Hans Multop and his designs that led to post-war American aircraft. Alexander Lippisch, who seems to have had a large effect on post-war American aircraft. And we really need more historical research into the archives, into the company records, to find out exactly how these technologies were transferred from Germany and how they were used in the U.S. and other countries. That was the U.S. Here's the U.K. These were German-speaking aerodynamicists who were taken to the U.K. after the war. And helped to develop very advanced aircraft that the British had after the war, like the Avro Vulcan here. Again, notice the flying wing type design, and even the Concorde here, which they developed. So to summarize all this, we've talked about the German nuclear payloads and the three different methods of delivering those, the land-launched missiles, sub-launched missiles, and intercontinental jet bombers. And it's clear from the evidence I've shown from the archives that all of these technologies were advanced to a very great degree during the war, much more advanced than you'd read in standard history books. But we really need more research in archives and in the field to find out exactly how far these technologies got during the war, and perhaps more importantly, to find out exactly how much these wartime German technologies influenced more famous post-war programs in the US and Soviet Union, France, UK, and other countries. So I'd strongly encourage anybody who's interested to first look at the documents I found, and they're online on my website, and then use those and go digging into any archives you can and see what additional information you can find. All right, I'll stop there. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you very much for presenting that to us. I think there's a lot of information provided there. And I would, with you, along with you, encourage anyone that has some additional information or can do some additional research to begin by contacting you through your website and continue to follow this as long as. There's information being brought up. What are you looking at now? What's your future plans?
I'm hoping to go back to the archives and do a little more digging. And I've heard from a couple of people who are digging through archives. So we're trying to find more information about these various programs. And one thing that interests me is not just these technologies, but rather the system behind them. What was it that enabled there to be so many revolutionary innovations coming out of this fairly small region, this fairly small period of time? So what factors generally promoted scientific innovation? Those can be transferred and used even now. How could we encourage modern universities and research systems to support revolutionary innovation as much as possible?
You might also mention that you're providing some webinars that people can participate in. You've done a couple of them. I think you've got another one scheduled. You want to mention those?
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, I periodically do these presentations by Zoom with a live studio audience. So if you'd like to be in the live studio audience remotely online, well, please contact me via my website there, send me an email, and I'll put you on the list. But it's kind of a loose collaboration of archival researchers everywhere from California to the Balkans, all investigating different aspects of this.
And remind our viewers what your website link is.
Sure, so it's up here, writerinstitute.org.
Yeah, there you go. Writerinstitute.org, and then just send Todd an email, and he will give you the links to the upcoming programs that he presents. Anything else, Todd?
No, I think that'll do it. I really appreciate your having me back.
Glad to do it. It's been a good run. I think you've provided a lot of useful information. And folks, thanks very much for joining Hidden History Stories from the Secret City.